Welcome, everyone. This is our second Sunday in the month of July. And in the month of July, every year, we do this intergenerational worship where we see the young ones and the older ones and then the old ones like me, and we're all together. And we're realizing that worship is not just an individual thing. It's a family thing. In fact, when we go to heaven, what is worship going to look like? Is it going to be one group singing their Hillsong songs, another group singing their Bethel songs, another group singing their old-timer songs and their hymns? No, we're all going to be together singing the same songs, new songs, forever. We're going to be all together enjoying the sense of we are family. Across generations, across genders, across, there are going to be no more classes, really, across ethnicities. That's the great part. We're practicing for heaven. And so it means also that in many ways, as we worship, we have to deal with some inconveniences. We have to realize that not everything is at our exact level all the time. But actually, that's what the great part of worship is. It stretches us to make room for other people who are not just like us. There's a whole generation who are worshiping as narcissists. That big word means I love myself and everything should apply to me. But what is Christ like? He is so other-centered. So the worshiping body of Christ, the bride of Christ, looks like him, able to make room for others in a hospitable way, but also to able to engage God together. This season we're going through head, heart, and hands. What it means to grow at our different levels, of course, but the same level of maturity for everyone, as we talked about last week, is the maturity and the fullness of Christ. Well, one of the ways that we're going to try to help the kids from different ages as well to stay engaged and help them, give them touch points and anchor points to maybe to talk even with their parents is something visual, something that's cue and response. And I don't know what cue and response, if you understand what that is. And what we do is we supply binders. Everybody got their binders? Okay, everybody got your binders? Okay, if you were here last week, you know what we're doing, but I'm going to give you a quick reminder. As a blank page for your cover, you can just paint or color whatever you want. Today we're doing heads, so if you want, you can color some head there, images there. You've been given coloring sheets. And from here on out, our coloring sheets are being custom made by Kathy Lee. So let's give Kathy Lee a hand. Yes. She's very good at drawing, and so one that's for the younger age and one for the little older age, but each of them have these little slots where you can put in stickers, right? And how did the stickers work last week? I noticed that some of the kids were a little too fast, and they just go, bam, 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 right? You have to wait because you don't know which sticker goes in where. It's a way to help us to follow this as a cue and response. So every time it's time for a sticker and a response, like a fill-in or so on and so forth, you'll hear this. Last week it was a little too loud, freaked people out. Yes, but as long as you can hear that, you'll also see that there's a specific sticker will come out. Right now you're seeing the three for today, and there'll be a little fill-in response. And so just be ready for that. Parents, you can help your kids, but if don't do it for them. Yeah, just help them. Because at the end, of course, what ends up happening is there is a prize, right? Yes. Yes, this is what everybody, all the kids are waiting for. And just like last week, some kids actually got their on-time prize. There was a little clock face showing 11 o'clock, old school version, not the digital version. And if you come by then, there's a stamp that's placed on it. And when it's time to get your prize, you get two. And so we're going to keep doing that. All right. I want to basically shift now to talk about the content of our message. What are we going to think and talk about afterwards? And this is our prayer each time, what does God want us to hear? How does God want us to grow and respond? Because God is a communicative God. He speaks. He shares. He prompts. He keeps us accountable. He has plans. And he's such a relational God. And so the clearest picture of who God is shown as God as Father, God as husband, right? God is friend. God is teacher. These are beautiful descriptions of who God is, how he relates to us. Well, I am a father, and so I know what that looks like to want so much for your child to grow and to be walking with them and teaching them and enjoying even the learning process. I got permission for this, but this is Ellie. And this is when she's about 3 years old. And as you, she's a pastor's daughter. She didn't have any choice in it, so she was being taught how to pray before her meal. That's her cereal. And she's being taught to pray. I don't know what she prayed, but she looks like she's praying. I don't know. Scrunching. Maybe she's following what she sees in me. I do this when I pray. I scrunch my nose up, right? Put my hands together. And we taught her the Lord's Prayer. We taught her different ways to pray. And so she went to Sunday school. Okay? On Sundays, she would be learning about God and about Jesus. We were at a church where her teachers were not full English speakers. And so when she was learning, in such a way that she would come home and we'd ask her, Ellie, what did you learn today? And she would be like, I learned about Jesus. Right? No, Ellie, Jesus. Repeat after me, Jesus. Jesus. My teacher said Jesus. Right? So she's a good learner, right? She even bucked and responded to us. But along the way, she's 3 years old, and we're planning to tell her, you don't just go to school on Sundays. You get to go to school like Monday through Friday. And it's a different kind of school. It's not a Sunday school. It's a learning school. She's like, learning school? Right? She's kind of excited about it. She didn't know what this thing was, but that's what she would learn. Because the only learning school she had was our home. And she had a lot of questions, like all little children do. And she would ask questions like, why is the sky blue? Why is the grass green? Why is this? Why is that? Why is this? What is this? What is that? And my wife, after coming home from a hard day of work, she really didn't have the energy to explain to her and respond to all of her millions of questions. So my wife is very smart, and she decided that's my husband's job. And the way that she told Ellie, I don't want to answer your questions, is not by saying, get away from me, I don't want to answer your questions, I'm tired. She would say, I don't know. And so Ellie would come up to her and say, Mommy, why is the sky blue? I don't know. Okay. Why is chicken taste like chicken? Yeah, that's a funny question, right? I don't know, right? And so she would kind of wonder, and she would come to me, and I would do my best. I would find my way through it, trying to explain to her sometimes a little too much information. Well, the sky is blue because of the refraction off of the different molecules in the sky. And she'd be like, right? So she had a hard time, poor kid, growing up. But she kind of made some conclusions. Huh. Every time I ask Mom, she doesn't know. And she's expecting me to go to learning school where you learn. So one time, she got fed up, and my wife is like, I don't know. And so she said to Mom, Mom, you don't know so much. You need to go to learning school. Well, there's a lot of people who have that, not just appearance, but reality. If you ask them a question, right? Sometimes those late night shows, they do a great job. They'll ask a simple question, right? About Declaration of Independence, about how many states there are, or simple question about who's president or so on. And the most ridiculous answers, there is a pretty strong level of ignorance about basic facts in the United States that people actually don't know that much. The sad part is, the group who actually are seen as, whether they are or not, sometimes they are, the ones who are the most ignorant, the ones who most know the least about our world and about God, are Christians. Okay? Sometimes Christians make other Christians cringe, right? No, that's not what Jesus said. Fake Christians, so ignorant, right? But That's the assumption of a lot of people, especially in New York. If you're a Christian, you don't know so much. How could you believe in this God that you can't prove and still say you're an intelligent person, right? Well, there is almost a comfortable ignorance in this because, yes, it's true. God is beyond our full knowing. We can't absolutely know everything about him. There are places where he is really mysterious. And so, when we answer that way about who God is and about life and about nature and so on and so forth, people actually look at Christians and say, man, you guys are so comfortably ignorant. Bertrand Russell is kind of an atheist who really took Christians to task. And he said, most Christians would rather die than think. That's the Christians that he came across. He would ask them questions, and his conclusion is, he needs to go to learning school. Most Christians would rather die than think. In fact, they do. Well, the great part is the thinking Christians would agree. C.S. Lewis would say, God is, sorry, let's go back here. God is no fonder, God is no fonder, somehow that got wiped out. God is no fonder of intellectual slackers, okay, than any other kind of slacker. In other words, you can be a slacker in your life of faith. You can be a slacker as a friend or as a parent or as a worker. But actually, God is watching not only in terms of how we are growing in our intellectual capacities too. Okay? It's going to disappear, I think. Sorry. Somehow, yeah. God is no fonder of intellectual slackers as any other slackers. Because for a lot of ways, we can say ignorance is very bliss. It's easy to not have to deal with them. We'd rather not think. We'd rather die than think for some of us. These are tough questions. And in fact, it's too busy. There's so much to know. There's so much to grow. Why waste your time on thinking clearly about God, about the world, and how they work together? But there's something about the thinking process, the rational mind God's given us, that is so central to how we grow. That in fact, if we only obey, if we only do what we're told and we never think, our growth and our relationship in Christ is really, really thin. Some people would say that they look at the American church and say, wow, it is thousands of miles wide, 6 inches deep. The God who not only speaks to us and meets us through the scriptures and through the Spirit, He's the one who made everything. And in order to grow, something has to change in our mind. Our mind, our thinking has to be renewed. So in Romans chapter 12, it says, do not conform to the pattern of the world. Hey, Everett. But instead, be transformed, be changed, grow into who you're supposed to be through the changing, the renewing. Your mind is growing. It's being renewed. You're thinking deeper. You're thinking differently. In fact, when Jesus talks to us about the primary commandment, He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart. And that makes sense, right? We're supposed to love Him with everything, our passion, our deep compulsions. And Pastor Richard's going to talk about that next week. All your soul, every part of your integrated body and self. But He also includes here, and all your mind. That our thinking is a way to love God. Not just part of our mind, all of our mind. When we problem solve, when we learn something new, when we engage our universe, okay, when we find how amazing our world and our God is, and we use our brain to actually grow closer to God, serve Him better, then this is a new way of thinking. There's a spiritual thinking, an enlightened way to think about our world. When you're a Christian, you don't shut off your mind. Instead, you develop your mind. You grow. We're supposed to love God with not just all of our hearts and our souls, but all of our minds. All right, you got it? Yes. You got it? So a Christian should love the God not only with knowing the Bible and knowing the Christian songs, but knowing about the world, knowing about spiders and about chemistry and about even computers. These are ways, because everything is a part of God's word which He created. Everything is a way, even our thinking process, a way to honor and to love Him. Our world is actually fantastic. It's amazing. I just read an article that spiders, I hate spiders. They bite me. I'm allergic to them. I think they're really stupid. Spiders are the most amazing creatures. Okay? I just learned that they actually fly using electricity in the air. It's just amazing how they know how to do that. Spiders catch wind drifts and then they skate on electricity in the air. It's just, what? They can make webbing that with ultraviolet, actually, they paint a picture of a flower. So flies will come, and bees will come, and other flying insects will come because they see the flower that's hidden in the webbing. It's just amazing what God has created. And there's a place for us to use every part of our minds to know Him, to worship Him, and actually to grow in our spiritual life with Him and with others. We're supposed to love God, not just with our passions and our souls and our bodies, but with all of our minds. All right. Well, okay, that didn't work out well. Sorry. The fonts are off. Here, let me walk you through this. So, this is what's going on. Most people, when they think of Christians and how we're supposed to love God with our minds, they actually would say, no, Christians are the most ignorant people. In fact, we have proof. In history, there's this 1,000-year period between 500 AD and, or CE, depending on which you use, and 1500, where this massive chunk of our history, almost everybody in Europe was Christian, but they call them the Middle Ages. But what do they call them? The Dark Ages, right? Why is it the Dark Ages? Because they say after Rome fell, all the barbarians took control. There was no education. There was no art. Nothing was happening. There was the Black Plague. Everybody was superstitious. Everybody hated each other. The church was bad. That's the darkest time in all of Europe. And that's what we're taught. If you see movies, that's what they say. They show you Christians being so superstitious, so unable to love God, so small-minded. But in fact, if you're a good historian, you find out that, wait, that was not the case at all. That was not the case at all. Okay? In fact, there is this guy, his name is Rodney Stark, and he wrote this book called Victory of Reason. Okay, so those of you who like to read, this is a fantastic book. In fact, it's very readable, and it actually walks you through all the misconceptions about how Christians lived and built society and civilization in the Middle Ages. When everybody's saying it's the darkest time, did you know that amazing innovations were happening? Because Rome fell, and the tyrants of Rome, the powerful people in Rome, they were squeezing every life and every strength out of everybody else. They made this incredible Colosseum and these roads. How? Using slaves. But when Rome fell, over the course of time, Christians in Europe, they got rid of slavery. Did you know that? And they began to actually live their lives, not only freedom, but amazing health. Those windmills that you see in like Netherlands and Dutch places, they all came up during the Middle Ages because they were using wind power. They were using water, like they're damming water and using as power sources to grind and so on and so forth. So much so that they said on average, one out of every family in Europe had access, one out of 50 families in Europe had access to a water mill. That's how many there were. There were so many windmills that they had to argue about who had property over wind, which wind. This is how they were developed. They developed the plow, they developed the horse collar, and so they were farming like crazy. People were living really well. They were developing their economic system. They were developing their art and their, if you go to any, like the Met or so on and so forth, you'd be amazed at the level of beauty and art there was in the Dark Ages. It was Christians. And the reason why I'm saying this is because when you look at a certain period of time, right as kind of Christianity is developing in the quote-unquote Dark Ages, and you're looking at Islam and you're looking at China, the two main world powers, guess what? Nobody in China or in Islam had these kinds of technological, had these kinds of cultural, artistic developments. In fact, Chinese scholars are actually asking themselves that question. How is it we have all these resources, all these people, and this small, dark, backward country that lost one-third of its population, one-half of its population twice? They grew so fast and so strong. They wanted to know. And you know what the interesting solution is? The Chinese scholars, the historians said, it wasn't resources. It wasn't technology. You know why they say Europe grew so fast and so strong? It was faith. It was their belief in a rational God that caused them to actually invest and to change the way they live. They wanted to love God with their minds because their God was a God who had a mind, and it changed their life and their living. This is a simple way of kind of wrapping up of what he said. The Christian image of God, as opposed to the Muslim image, as opposed to the Chinese image of God, the Taoists and others, the Christian image of God is that a rational being, somebody who thinks and thinks regularly and consistently, a rational being who believes in human progress. That, in fact, a lot of cultures wouldn't try to figure out nature because it's a mystery, it's whimsical. Why invest there? But they knew God is a God of moral laws, and so he is also a God, also in his creation. There should be a law-like nature to it. And God wants people to grow and develop. There's a future he wants to bring them to. And so they had so much encouragement theologically in their faith to put all of their energy into how do we use our mind to make life better. More fully revealing himself as humans gain capacity to better understand is actually wrapping up him saying, the Christians, if you read their writing, they believed that as they grew up in the faith, as they grew up, they would understand God more. As they studied, they would understand God more. They had so much faith about this God that they could love God with their mind. And no other religion, no other massive culture had that. Moreover, because God is a rational being and the universe is his personal creation, it necessarily has a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting increased human comprehension. It's like they believe we were like children. And the more we study and more we learn, we can know more about God and we can live more the way he wants to. That's what they believed, and that's how they developed their life in the Middle Ages. He's saying this was the key to many intellectual undertakings, among them the rise of science. What is he saying? Historians will say Christianity and science are not against each other. Science only came about in Europe because in Europe there was a faith-based. Do you understand that? That they could say, we can put this kind of investment, and it doesn't block God. There's no argument against this. In fact, it's saying, science is a part of knowing God. You know who the first creators of university was? Higher learning centers. The first creators in the Middle Ages were Christians, because they believed God wanted us to love him with all of our minds. Most universities are places now where you can't be a Christian out in public because you get slammed. I got slammed when I was in university. But all the universities in the United States, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, so on and so forth, they were all started off as Christian institutions. Why? Because Christians knew God wanted us to love him with our minds. The idea that science is against Christianity is blatantly false. Albert Einstein versus Jesus, arm wrestling, right? Blatantly false. Okay? Because Christians care about truth, whether it's in the world or it's in the heart, what's in the scriptures or in creation. Here's the problem. In the United States, people are not caring about truth anymore. The word for the year is post-truth. You know that they make a new word every year to kind of say, this is that's hitting all of the media and the consciousness of people who are paying attention. The word for the year is post-truth. We are in a post-truth era. People don't care, is it true or not? They don't care about data. They don't care about evidence. They don't care about science, really. They don't care about what is true. They care about what they want to believe. And you know what the sad part is? It's Christians who have a God who is a rational being who made this stable universe inviting deeper comprehension. It's Christians who are the most ignorant of all, who actually don't care about the truth, are happy to live in a post-truth environment. And this is going to be growing more so. This is actually something that this one guy named Mark Knoll, a historian, it's been a while, I think in the 90s, he wrote a book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. He actually said, we're in trouble because Christians, evangelicals, people who believe in the Bible, don't care about truth anymore. We're not thinking. We're not loving God with our minds. Because somewhere along the way, what's going to happen is we're going to be divorced from Jesus. It's Jesus who said, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. Okay? He is the way to the Father. Relationally, you can't get to God. You can't know God. But he also is this concrete, objective, real truth about God. He himself is the living embodiment of truth. That as we wrestle with his truth,
we get to live well and right. And so as a Christian, we want to love God with all of our minds. We have to value truth. Truth has to be important to us. I don't know about you, but I'm actually a scientist by trade. And so when I do my Bible reading, I'm paying attention to data. I'm paying attention to what's being said. I'm not paying attention to, this is what I think it feels like. I'm looking carefully at history. I'm looking carefully at truth. I'm a scientist by trade, and that helps me. But actually, I know you don't have to be a scientist. As a Christian, you should care about what is real, what is truth. You should, if somebody says something, if I tell you something, you should say, where is it in the Bible? Where is it in the evidence? Now, we can't know everything, but we should actually be serious about the truth. We should value it. We should teach our children the truth matters, even when it costs us something, as it did Jesus, as it did all of those who follow him. Okay? Jesus cared about the truth. This is 12-year-old Jesus. Okay, and you know the story. He's left home alone, but actually temple alone. His parents forget about him, and he's stuck in the temple for 3 days. And what is he doing? Mommy, Daddy. No, he's sitting there asking all kinds of questions to the greatest minds of their country, the rabbis and everybody there, publicly. And he's giving answers. He is so consumed with the truth that at age 12, guess what? He is talking and engaging and dialoguing about the truth of God with the greatest minds of his generation, of his people. That's the way it should be. Did you know that 12-year-olds in their education system, many of them have already not only memorized the first 5 books of the Bible, okay, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. 12-year-olds will have memorized that. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of, you know, valuing truth. Some of them, as they're growing into and continuing on, they will have memorized the whole Old Testament. Not just rabbis, just people. That's what it means to be a part of the people of God, to really care about God's truth and the truth of the world, all truth. Okay? And so, as we're kind of wrapping this out, I wanted to point out how important it is for us as Christians. If God is who he says he is, then he's inviting us to know him and love him, to serve him with all of our minds. And so there's an encouragement here in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, not just what you see in the scriptures, whatever is true, echoed in the world, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, and so on and so forth out. Guess what? These are the things that we should think about. We should intentionally look to love God with our minds. Okay? That should be how we live. We should be looking for what is true, what is beautiful. All Christians should be lovers of art. All Christians should be lovers of everything high and wonderful that blesses and encourages and brings life. All Christians should be Bible scholars. All Christians should be theologians, people who handle the truth. Not just pastors, all of us. It's not a question whether you do theology, think about God, and know him that way, or not. That's not the question. It's whether you do it well or you do it poorly. Because everybody is a theologian in that sense. Jesus was, and so are we called to be. Okay? So we're called to actually, like Jesus, hunt for, seek whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is excellent and beautiful. We're supposed to be curious. Did you know that? You're supposed to be curious. Something happens and you're like, oh, like a little child. Why? Why is this important? God, where are you in this? What do you want to show us? Be curious about the places in the Bible you don't quite understand. Okay? A lot of pastors will say, just believe. No. What is in the scriptures? Because it's given to us. How do we dig into them and understand? Sometimes scriptures look like they're saying two different things. When you look carefully, it's actually giving you two sides of the one coin. Okay? We should be curious about our world. We should be curious about humanity, about creation. Okay? We should be thinking questions and asking questions. Okay? So if your child says, why is the sky blue, so on and so forth, you know, you can say, I don't know, but you can say, I don't know, let me find out. Let me give you my best learning experience, okay? It's not perfect, it never is, but I'm going to learn too. Most of us, by the time you get to my age, I'm 48, most of us have stopped being curious. Oh, I'm so tired of books. I'm so tired of people talking. It's like, oh, I know everything I want to know and I'm done. But actually, what it means to be a Christian is to love God with all your mind, all the way through. And if you've lost your curiosity, if you lost your marveling, you see something, you go, oh my gosh, this is so beautiful. Why? Something is off in your relationship with God. Because God will take that, your curiosity, your marveling, your hunger, and he will grow you deeper. You know, Paul, the Apostle Paul, could not grow deeper without wrestling with truth. At the later stages of his life, as he has already been one of the top minds of his generation, he had to redo everything because he was hungering, he was curious, he wanted to know. That's the way it should be for us. All right. I'm going to give one more verse and a few more things and we're almost done. I love this verse. This helps me a lot. Because sometimes you just can't figure everything out. You can't understand everything. You're not supposed to. We're limited. And so there's this reminder that the secret things about who God is, about how we're supposed to live, the bigger questions of the universe, you know, so on and so forth, secret things belong to the Lord our God. Because God is so good, he has planned for us to grow in our understanding and our minds. And so what does he say? The things that he's shown to us, revealed to us through his scriptures and through history, these things belong to us and our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law. Isn't that interesting? Some of this is blocked off. It's locked. You cannot access it. Okay? As a scientist, we know this to be true in a lot of kinds of ways. But even as a scholar, as a Bible scholar, you know this. But there is a lot that God is constantly revealing, saying, this is what I'm like. This is who I am. This is how we are called to live. And everything we learn, it is good for not just us, but for those who are following. So I want you to think about this. How do you love God with your mind? Crack a book, okay? Okay, I'm not talking about like just any book. A book that's going to be a little challenging. A book that actually makes you think. A book that actually maybe causes you to wrestle a bit about what is true about God and our world. Okay? Here's some book recommendations. All right. So, there's a book called Fit Bodies and Fat Minds. Right? Isn't that funny? Fit Bodies and Fat Minds. It's not that big. It's a thin book. And the guy actually, he's the one who's saying, what happened to Christians? We used to be like Puritans who had such a love for truth and knowledge. What happened to us? And he walks you through some of the reasons why in a very readable kind of way. He kind of like starts off by saying he went to this one conference and he's talking about this and he's projecting his book, promoting his book, and this one beautiful blonde lady stands up and asks him a question. Dr. Guinness, tell me, after he's talking about how important it is to think about have a clear mind and a faith that actually loves God with all your mind, she goes, you've been telling us all this about your mind, but how's your body, right? And his response was, lady, how's your mind? In other words, we are so focused on having fit bodies that our minds are not only flabby, but actually really off. It's a great book for us. A second book that's a little more chewy, but actually is a great book if you're interested, is The Christian Mind, How to Think Like a Christian. And the last book I have for you is called Take and Read. One of my professors named Eugene Peterson, he loved to read all kinds of books. Not just as a pastor, not only like the Christian books, but novels, poetry books, other kinds of things. And so he said, these are a bunch of different kinds of genres, and these are some great books that you might not have heard of, and this is what I, like a quick annotated bibliography, this is what I got out of it, really quick. So if you don't know what to read, buy that book and start off on a few. Yeah, some of them are a little chewy, I gotta say. One book took me 3 years to read. I love that book. It's one of my favorite books, right? Anyway, So let's finish off with this. Our thought life to God matters. If you don't think clearly, you will not know God clearly. You will not love God clearly. Okay. Paul says stuff like, I am convinced, something convinced this rational thinking man that nothing can separate him from the love of Christ. It wasn't just experience. It was what he saw, the truth of who God was. When push comes to shove, you haven't thought clearly, you haven't loved God with your mind, you don't know him, guess what? You're not going to be able to do the rest of the stuff, the heart stuff and the hand stuff. But it goes like, doesn't it? It starts here, then it moves down to the heart and moves forward to the hand. In fact, for a lot of people, that is the most natural, meaningful, full-blown way of loving God. I want you to bow your heads with me.